Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, the very last day of July. This morning, we talk about traffic post-tsunami. Here in Honolulu, it was a repeat of gridlock that we saw during the last tsunami scare. We hear from state and city transportation officials, what can we do better? We learn about a bird conservation project on Midway. How did our feathered friends fare with the threat of big waves? We hear from a climate center that's waiting on $10 million in federal funding for students and early career researchers. We hear about a vital program that's been around for more than 100 years, providing farmers with resources and seeds. And remote control cars have been around for eons, but what's this about drift races? We go along on the ride, slip sliding around. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. In the countdown to this week's tsunami, thousands of motorists were stuck in gridlock in our Honolulu. At a news conference on Wednesday, Department of Transportation Director Ed Sniffen told reporters about the delicate dance of traffic management, all happening at the Joint Traffic Management Center.
At Joint Traffic Management Center, it's connected to most of the signals on Oahu, so we could real-time adjust them. And I'll say that the city was tremendous partners in this. At the Joint Traffic Management Center, because we had the city, the state, and all emergency responders sitting together, we could see the traffic buildup in different areas. We could change the signals and see how it affected that traffic buildup in different portions and see if we had to send police officers out there to ensure that we could push things further. So yes, we had real-time access to different intersections. In general, though, because the volumes were so high and the capacity couldn't keep up with it, in some cases, it wasn't enough to just change the signal timing. We had to get physical officers out there to make sure we pushed in.
And City Transportation Services Director Roger Morton talked with us this morning about what, if anything, could have been done to ease the congestion and stress of drivers on the road. He, along with state transportation and emergency management officials, are to follow up on ways to improve messaging to help take the pressure off our roadways and highways.
So one of the messages that we've got to refine and make it a little bit is, if you're in a safe place, stay in your safe place if you can. Now, I get it that people have real lives and they have children and they have other things, and so not everybody can do that. But if you can, particularly with this type of event that's a few hours away, that's better than just jamming up our freeways. If we had enough capacity on our freeways, we wouldn't have any rush hour traffic at all. We don't have that kind of capacity.
Well, when we're talking about managing traffic, particularly in the downtown corridor, because you've got high rises and you've got hundreds of employees that are trying to get out onto those main arteries. And I know my daughter works and lives in Kaka'ako and downtown, and she said her coworkers were stuck in their building for 45 minutes to an hour. They couldn't even get on the surface streets. So yeah, the whole messaging, because we've got so many high rises and many more coming up.
And really, above the fourth floor and everything, you're in a safe place. So for office workers, for residential people, staying in that safe place keeps you safe, and it also keeps those roadway space available for those that can't do that.
And, you know, we did hear nightmare stories about people who were trying to get out of Waikiki and trying to get home. They want to get out of the inundation areas, and they were just stuck on the Alawai, on Ala Moana Boulevard. So it was pretty nightmarish.
Yeah, even the H1 freeway, it was gridlocked. It wasn't moving. And when it's not like that, I mean, a lane of travel on the H1 can handle 2,000 cars an hour. But if it's gridlocked, that capacity is going to go way down. And that's what occurred. That's just a traffic phenomena that, you know, that as you saturate a system with more than 30 or 40 cars per mile, that's the way highway engineers measure it, the capacity of the road goes down. So a lot of people on the surface streets where everything was backed up because they were headed for the east-west routes, Ala Moana Boulevard, King Street, especially the freeway.
I know I had relatives that were stuck on Alamoana Boulevard. They couldn't even get across the bridge there. And I had called the Alamoana Shopping Center security, and they had said, we're closed, but we're not turning people away if they need to seek refuge. But I understand there were people parking on the median and figuring, oh, I can get somewhere faster walking or running, whatever the case may be. So you folks will be meeting what to reassess and talk about the messaging going forward?
Well, we've already met and we've had some preliminary things. And what we've decided is that we do need to have a more in-depth, a statewide type of approach for how can we do this better? What are the messages that we can say? We know that a lot of people, you know, that were in very safe places. We heard stories of people in Mililani that wanted to go home to Kapolei and so on. And I get that. One of the messages that we have to get out there is if you're in a safe place and you can stay there, then stay there. This is not a hurricane where we get 7 or 8 days of monitoring. This is something where we get 5 or 6 hours.
And I was stuck on South Street trying to get from Ala Moana to Kapi'olani. It took me an hour. But while I was stuck in traffic, there were a number of police cars that were making their way through. So talk about how you were able to coordinate with the Honolulu Police Department. I don't know if they were helping to man some of the traffic lights.
I did get involved in a couple of areas. One was downtown, where we relied upon HPD to help facilitate the movement of traffic away from downtown, particularly as we were getting to the 6 p.m., 6:30 p.m. time frame. So I know that there was places. I don't have the full complement of where HPD was. I know that they had closed some highways on the west side, and their manpower was used in many different ways.
We did reach out to HPD yesterday to try and get a better handle, and I'm told this morning they're going to come out with some statement about the coordination effort.
Okay.
But yeah, we just need to do better the next time around.
Again, when we do have an emergency, there's a traffic jams are a fact of life, and we need to figure out not how, because our physical capacity to move vehicles only has a finite amount of ability. And so we need to figure out ways that we can reduce the number of vehicles demanding to use the highways, because the highways just physically will not accommodate all the demand if everybody goes on the highway at the same time.
What can you tell us about the operations of the bus, the handy van, and rail?
Sure. I think that as for the bus, I give a lot of credit to them. They followed the plan that we provided for them. They continued service and stopped service for any trip starting at 6 p.m. or later. So they didn't run a trip after that. That meant that we had about 65 buses with people on them that we had to evacuate to a different place, to a district park or to a high school and things like that. And our bus operator stayed with the group and got them home afterwards. So kudos to them. For the handy van, a lot of people canceled their travel because they knew about the alert. Handy van got everybody home. They did shelter people at the handy van office building during the height of the event, and then they made sure that they got everybody home. On Skyline operated without anything until the last trip arrived about 7 p.m. I wish that we were already in segment two, where we would have been running until 10:30 or longer, but no issues with that. We did notice that in frustration, people got off buses in higher numbers than normal and just got on Skyline to go out to Kapolei. Now, a lot of people, there was a perception by a lot of people that we had canceled bus service earlier than we did, but most of that, frankly, was just late traffic, late buses. Because 97% of our buses were running late in the 6:30, 7 p.m. time frame.
Yeah, I imagine it was probably more chaotic for them. You're carrying so many people.
But the drivers were stellar. They have families too, but they continued. They camped out with the people in the shelters where they were sheltering people, particularly on the west side.
We talked to the governor the other day, and we were discussing that, yeah, it was probably a good thing that this happened this week versus when all the children are back in school. and that could have created a whole another wrinkle.
Absolutely. If schools had been in session, that pickup time at school would have coincided with the event. And we also have the 3 p.m. dismissal time at Pearl Harbor for the shipyard. And that adds, that's at the shipyard alone, there's 6,000 workers. And their shifts tend to end about 3 p.m. You know, that added to that, even on a normal day, that adds a significant amount of traffic to the highway system. And it's a pre-rush hour type of load that goes out there and extends our rush hour. But that was another issue. We did have some things that we want to look at. We had some building owners that evacuated their high-rise buildings. And I think that we've got to get to the BOMA, to the building owners, and try to make the association, try to get its owners to, especially with a tsunami, to understand it's a safe place and we should allow people, office workers, to stay in the office and ride out the event.
Right, evacuate vertically, absolutely.
Yeah, just vertical for that. So, you know, there's a lot of lessons learned. As painful as it was a full-scale exercise for city and state emergency responders to try to cope with that. And traffic, obviously, is the one area that has been frustrating to people. But we've got to just get to that point where we understand that I could turn the lights on green 100% of the time, but if the car can't get through the intersection because of the congestion, it's not just a green time issue, and it's not just a facilitating traffic movement. The issue is the roadways and the highways don't have the capacity to deal with a surge of demand all at one time.
That was City Transportation Director Roger Morton talking to us about the traffic nightmare that many drivers got caught up in on Tuesday.
Get ready to make fun of the headlines live. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is coming to Honolulu in October. To show our appreciation, HPR members get first access to tickets starting August 6th. Make sure you're ready. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait. Sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners and Hawaii Pacific University.
Monsoon season is part of the rhythm of life in South Asia, but climate change is making monsoon rains less predictable and more dangerous.
So instead of moderate rains spread through the season, we are having long dry spells and then suddenly short spells of heavy rains.
Monsoons are not what they used to be. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Midway Atoll played a key role in detecting the risk of a tsunami to Hawaii on Tuesday night. And it was there at around 6 p.m. that waves made landfall, measuring 6 feet from peak to trough. One group of especially vulnerable inhabitants at Midway were 100 endangered Laysan finches. The birds had been moved there just last week as part of a plan to reestablish native bird populations. We're told that the birds that were being tracked with special equipment survived the tsunami. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife says there were no major impacts to its facilities on Midway due to the tsunami waves, and in the coming days, its team will be assessing any additional impacts to the atoll. The translocation of the finches marks the first time in 8 decades that their songs could be heard on Midway Atoll. Rats completely eliminated the birds in the 1940s, but for the past 5 years, biologists have been working to bring the finches, known as ekupu'u, back to the fields and skies of Midway. The conversation's Lillian Song talked with Jared Underwood. He's a superintendent for Papahanao Mokuakea Marine National Monument.
So I arrived to Midway 2 weeks ago, at the start of the field component of this project, where we arrived at Midway and then went to Manawai or Pearl and Hermes Atoll to capture the finches and bring them back here. The Laysan finch itself is roughly the size of the house sparrow that you see around Hawaii. It's also similar in size to the palila, which is another endemic finch to Hawaii, lives on the Big Island. So they're fairly small birds, a couple inches long. These remote atolls in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands span almost 1,500 miles from the rest of the main Hawaiian Islands. And the islands themselves are pretty small, range in size from a couple hundred feet long and a couple hundred feet wide to places like Laysan and Midway, which are a mile or two long and half a mile or a mile wide. So they're small, but they're not as small as some of the speck ones that are only a few hundred feet of sand.
So in the 90s, the rats were extirpated. So that means no more dangers from the rats. Are there any other dangers?
We hope not in the short term. The island that they were translocated to, Eastern Island on Midway, has abundant food resources. It's a slightly higher island. Ultimately, the goal is for this species and the other passerines that are native to northwestern Hawaiian Islands to be translocated back to the main Hawaiian Islands, which according to fossil records used to also occupy. Many of these islands here in northwestern Hawaiian Islands are very low-lying. They face threats of tsunamis, erosion of the island, things that we can't control or have very little ability to control. We would like ultimately to return them in the long term to higher islands in the main Hawaiian Islands. Right now, that's not possible because of potential predators and the same diseases that are affecting our native Hawaiian birds. For me, my passion is Hawaii's native species and their conservation. And so for me, this is taking a step in that direction to increasing the number of populations of the Laysan finch, making sure that it has a higher likelihood to persist into the future. This has been an inspirational story to be able to do something that actually is having a tangible, real impact for one of our native species. In the early 1900s, rabbits were introduced to the island and denuded the entire island of Laysan of vegetation almost completely. And that caused the finches to drop to a really low number, probably only tens. We don't know exactly how many were left, but they're a pretty resilient species. So once the rabbits were extirpated and the vegetation started coming back, they were able to bounce back. But that also is because they have the ability to adapt and they're not just tied to a single source of food or a single type of flower or something like that. They can certainly survive in most places in Hawaii that have similar resources, low-lying areas.
You guys were able to release 100 of these finches, bringing these birds that haven't been able to live on Midway back. What was that release like? That's a lot of birds.
Yeah, it was actually quite a interesting and exciting event. We were able to bring the birds overnight on a ship. And as soon as the ship arrived, we were able to take a smaller boat and take the finches in their transports to Eastern Island, one of the islands in Midway Atoll. And then we were able to walk them to kind of the center of the island where we had decided to release them. Quiet and reverent experience as we tried not to make the situation stressful for them. So we just kind of quietly opened their doors and let them out. And almost immediately the birds started singing and foraging, you know, looking for food, trying things out in their new habitat. And so it was really exciting and fulfilling for us to see these birds kind of take to their new home so readily. It was something that I won't forget.
Through the help of your team, able to move that large number of birds, the visuals of it, just so fascinated by that. Those were like 100 wooden, it kind of felt like a big condo of birdhouses being shipped.
It kind of was that, yeah. Each had their own little individual house and that I think kept them less stressed and happy. Yeah, so when we captured each of the finches on Manawai, we were able to put a unique color combination of bands on their legs so that we would be able to track them once they were released to minimize stress and make sure they were able to get enough food and water. They were placed in individual cages or little boxes where they were monitored, weighed to make sure they were eating. They were fed a variety of foods to make sure they were able to find something they were interested in eating. They were given water. And so we had several people whose job was just to make sure that the finches we had captured while we were on Manavai were well taken care of until we could release them. We mostly were able, these finches are not, like many of the birds in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, they're not afraid of humans. They don't have a lot of experience with humans. So whereas birds on the main islands will fly away from you, the birds in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands are more curious than anything. So we were able to capture the birds on Manavai fairly easily because of that lack of fear of humans. Our goal was to make sure that all the finches we took were healthy and that they remained healthy until they were released. Now that they've been released, we have a team who is monitoring them. We did put radio transmitters on a selection of the birds so that we would be able to make sure we could find them. The island they were released on is rather large, so finding 100 birds can be a challenge as they spread out across the island. But we resight them and we're able to tell which birds they are by their unique band combinations.
That is so cool. Yeah. What is the ratio? What is the breakdown? Was it like a 50-50 male, female? And what is the lifespan of the finch?
So we actually don't have a lot of those questions answered yet. We believe that we captured a fairly equal selection of males and females, but we actually took a few feathers as samples and we're going to have those using genetics. We're going to find out exactly what our ratio was. We also tried to take both adult birds and juvenile birds so that there would be a variety of ages and experience on the island. Sometimes juvenile birds, as they disperse, are more willing to adapt to new environments. Lifespan is also not entirely clear. We believe they live a number of years, but we don't know exactly how long that is.
With a successful relocation, what are your plans and what is that timeline looking ahead?
There are three still existing species within the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. The Nihoa finch, the Laysan finch, and the Nihoa miller bird. About a decade ago, we transferred the Nihoa miller bird to another island, so that would have multiple populations. Our next goal is to transfer the Nihoa finch to another island so that it will also have multiple populations. And then the Laysan finch to another island as well. Our goal is to try to spread the risk of having a catastrophic event cause the extinction of one of these species. So over the next few years, we hope to do those additional translocations while continuing to monitor the success and learn from this translocation as we prepare for those translocations.
Is there anything you would like to share with our listeners that we haven't touched on?
I would say two things. These species we've been talking about are endemic Hawaiian species, found nowhere else in the whole world. And we have, as people of Hawaii, an opportunity to conserve these species. They're part of our heritage. They're part of our culture. We hear a lot about the native Hawaiian forest birds, which also need conservation efforts. But there are these other species that are part of our endemic wildlife. I think the other thing I would say is that, you know, this effort was not just a Fish and Wildlife Service effort. We had a lot of partners who helped us. We relied on NOAA to use their ship to help transport the finches. We relied on other agencies and nonprofit organizations to help fund the translocation and provide technical support. We have people from two nonprofits who are part of our team helping to care for the birds. And like everything in Hawaii, we're stronger when we work together and use each other's expertise. I'd feel remiss if I didn't mention that this was really a group effort, and we're thankful to everyone who helped with this.
Well, Jared, I really envy you for where you get to say your office is. It was like, wow, you guys get to exist in this time space and do this work.
Well, I feel very lucky that I'm able to work in such an amazing place and see the things I get to see and do the things I get to do. What's amazing about the Papanamukuakea and the atolls that are here is that wildlife really is the dominant force. And they just find us as a curiosity, as opposed to a threat or being scared of us. We get to come into their world and immerse yourself and just be existing with the wildlife and just see them very up close, be able to observe just how they would act in the absence of humans. And this place is a special place that I don't know how many other places there are like it in the world where we're able to really just exist with wildlife in a place where they have no fear.
And that was U.S. Fish and Wildlife's Jarrett Underwood and HBR's Lillian Song. The Laysan Finch Relocation Project on Midway Atoll is an effort to safeguard the species. Ironically, tsunamis are a threat to their survival, and they were very lucky to have dodged the bullet this time. This morning, we hear more about cuts to climate research. Today, HPR's climate and energy reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote looks at a hub focus across the Pacific. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so tell us about this.
So what we're talking about today is the Pacific Islands Climate Adaptation Science Center, and it's one of nine climate research hubs in a network that spans the entire country. Our center is led by the University of Hawaii at Manoa, as well as UH Hilo and the University of Guam. You'll hear local researchers call it PTASC. And these centers, including ours, operate on federal funding that comes from the United States Geological Service, which is within the Department of the Interior. And so in February, our center, as well as two other hubs, one in the Northeast and one in South Central, applied to re-up their funding. So they were looking for awards of $10 million over the course of the next 5 years. I spoke with Darren Lerner. He's the center's executive director. And he said that the center has gone through this process before without issue, but this time they've hit a roadblock.
That process normally should wrap up no later than June, but we've been told that the rebid process has been paused. We really haven't received much more information than that as we near the end point for these three consortia.
And they have about 2 months left worth of funds, and they're worried that as the clock is ticking down on those, they won't get new funds in time to keep the center in operation.
There is definitely concern that the process won't resume before we run out, which would be September 30th. There's a fairly high level of uncertainty that, you know, frankly, even if in the next few days or couple of weeks, the process would have to move very quickly for the timing to connect, if you will, to that current end date.
And so if the center loses its funds, and what's that going to mean for climate research here in Hawaii?
So in this story, I spoke to several researchers who said that the center had played a really important role in their work, either through direct funding or by providing some sort of platform for their research to get into the hands of decision makers to make their work really actionable. And one of the things that also came up repeatedly is the support that this center provides to students and early career researchers. It really opens a door for people to get their first big project in climate science. And that $10 million that the center is waiting on will go towards funding the salaries of 25 graduate students engaging in climate research over the next 5 years, as well as about 50 summer internships for undergraduate students. So it is a huge source of early career support. And one of the person that I spoke to about this is Ryan Peroy. He's a professor at UH Hilo and also the director of the master's program in tropical conservation biology and environmental science there. Quite a mouthful. And he said that the center's support for students is really invaluable as Hawaii's universities work to train the next generation of scientists.
The PICAST funds have allowed students to carry out work that they would either have to incur, you know, large personal loans or not work on those projects, have to work on other projects that they may not be as interested in. So, yeah, I would say it's definitely been critical for our population of students here at UH Hilo.
Yeah, and that's the big lament, right? These are young minds, young researchers, and it's just a squeeze on their careers.
Yeah, and it does help researchers at every stage in their career. For instance, Professor Perroy is engaged in an ongoing project that's supported by PICASC, the center, and he was actually fresh off a trip from Pohnpei in the Federated States of Micronesia, and he was out there working with foresters in the region as part of this agroforestry project to support food security in the face of climate change. And a lot of it involves surveying the health of coconuts and breadfruit and forests using drones and artificial intelligence to see if these forests are healthy enough to enhance food security. And that project, again, it's been funded by the center, and he's working with a graduate student from Pohnpei who he was able to bring on that trip, and that was due to the center's support as well. So that's a great example of a lot of the things the center does. It creates these opportunities for researchers and students to work on these projects that are really unique to the Pacific, and then actually get the research that the scientists are generating into the hands of decision makers, resource managers, planning directors, so that they can take steps to support climate resilience in their communities.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that they've got people in their communities that are doing the work from those islands.
Exactly. Yeah. Another researcher I talked to, Thomas Giambaluca, he's a professor and climate scientist at UH Manoa. He's done several projects through the center about changing rainfall patterns and freshwater resources. He's really been there since the beginning. He said that the graduate students he works with on projects funded by the center are some of the best people and researchers that he's had the occasion to work with. And he said that the value of the center is that they're really a hub for this local climate data, this place-based climate data made by the people who live in those areas. And that's because climate models that were designed on the continent, on the U.S. continent, don't really account for Hawaii's unique topography and microclimates. And that's true of other places in the Pacific as well. And so the center's work isn't really in understanding how Hawaii's climate works and how it's changing, and getting that information out.
It's pretty much mandatory for any researchers who are seeking funding from PICASC to demonstrate that they're going to be able to produce not only scientifically valid results, but ones that are useful and that are available to those who need it. So, you know, a lot of our own efforts have gone into providing tools, resources that decision makers and resource managers and others can use to anticipate and adapt to climate variability and climate change that we're seeing in the islands. If PICASC ceases to exist, there would be a huge impact on research that's relevant to people in Hawaii and organizations in Hawaii. We would still have other sources of funding, and we'd be able to do some of the research that we're currently doing, but it would really curtail the kind of research that is most impactful for us here in Hawaii. So it would be a huge loss.
Yeah, it would create a big void.
Yeah, and that sentiment was echoed by all of the research that I talked to. Noah Lincoln is a researcher who's relatively new to PICASC, the center, but he said already he's getting so much more support in every stage of the process than he gets from other organizations that fund this kind of research. And this is already starting to affect the projects that the center supports. So in addition to the funding for the center itself, there was a group of projects, about 6 or 7 projects, that were approved at the end of last year. And I spoke to Lerner about this, and he says normally what would happen is that funding would come to the center, and then those researchers would be embraced into the fold of the center. They would get their funding, and they would be supported in the process by all of the researchers and executives at the Pacific Islands Climate Center. However, they were expecting that funding around March or April. That's typically when they get it. That funding has yet to come through, which is highly unusual. So on top of the funding for their center, those individual projects are also in limbo.
Yeah, and I know that there have been lots of legal challenges and, you know, freezing of funds and unfreezing and back and forth. And I don't know, have they gotten any indication, you know, when that might resume?
So they have inquired to USGS directly, which is a really important partner in this work. They work with a lot of scientists who are employed by that federal agency as well. They have not gotten any direct indication of when their bidding process will resume. However, Varner said there is one reason to be optimistic, and this is not the reason to be optimistic. The Trump administration, in the budget it submitted for USGS, cut funding to the Ecosystems Mission Area program. That's the umbrella program for the Climate Science Network. But Congress actually made that decision, and it's in its appropriations process now. And so far, committees in the House and Senate have preserved the Ecosystems Missions Area, so it's possible funding for the network could emerge intact.
Okay, so we have to keep our fingers crossed that that comes through for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We have been talking about the uncertainty for climate research. You can read Savannah's story on our website later today.
I'm Russell Subiono. Join me and Mehana Makainai for HPR's new podcast, Feathers and Fire. We'll take a closer look at every episode of the new Apple TV Plus series, Chief of War. Plus, special guests will share their behind-the-scenes stories. Listen to the pre-show episode on July 31st, and then regular episodes release on Saturdays starting August 2nd, wherever you get your podcasts.
Dismal polling numbers for the Democratic Party. A Wall Street Journal poll out this week finds that 63% of registered voters feel that Democrats are out of touch with Americans' everyday concerns. One scholar of social inequality says that does not surprise her at all.
Precarity is at the center of what's going on politically in the U.S.
Joan Williams on how the left lost the working class. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
This morning, Overstory Hawaii features a program that is vital in our community. This morning, Noel Fuji'i Oride joins us to talk about the University of Hawaii's Cooperative Extension Program. Good morning, Noel.
Yeah, good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, I'm so glad that you're focusing on this program, because I was hearing that the new dean of the College of Tropical Agriculture was really supportive of our extension agents across the state.
Oh, yeah. They really play an important role. These guys, they're a statewide team, and there's about 30, 32 extension agents right now, and they're supported by, you know, agricultural researchers and technicians and other staff. But they're located throughout the state, and they do a lot of important research. So everything from testing out new crops or crop varieties that could grow well in Hawaii and what conditions they need, to helping farmers and gardeners troubleshoot issues like around pests or diseases. And then they also provide a lot of education to farmers and then to our broader community.
Yeah, I mean, they really have the pulse on the agriculture community, because they're boots on the ground. They're out in the field, you know, talking to the farmers.
Yeah, that's really a great way to describe them. They've also, when I spoke with them, they would describe themselves as bridges, right? Bridges between the university and especially the university's research and then what the community's needs are. And so there were several research projects they mentioned that came out of community needs or community just interest. So one of them was looking at onion thrips. Thrips are a major threat to onion crops just around the world, and they easily become resistant to pesticides. And so there's an extension agent on Maui who does a yearly thrips pesticide trial to identify the best chemicals or pesticides to use. And so every year you have local food producers waiting to see what are the results of those trials so that they can implement what she finds.
And then I understand that the farmers are playing around with a new type of green onion?
Oh, I'm not too sure about the farmers, but yes, that was something that actually came out of the UH Extension program. So the team developed a new green onion variety that's easy to grow, and I believe it was especially targeted at home gardeners. And they unveiled it, I want to say, about a week ago at their urban garden center.
Okay, so it's early in the process of getting them out into the hands of farmers.
Yeah, but I mean, there are also other projects that they're working on. One Oahu Extension agent is working on a dried bean trial, and he's been doing that for several years, but looking at, you know, what types of beans and specifically what genotypes are going to grow well in Hawaii. And, you know, these bean varieties that he's looking into, they already tend to grow well in like drier areas, so they need less water and also less fertilizer. And so that's lower cost for a farmer than to invest in starting to grow this crop.
Well, you know, whether it's bunchy top and bananas or ring spot and papaya, right? I mean, the poor farmers are out there. They're battling all these different diseases and pests. And, you know, if the researchers at the University of Hawaii can help them figure out, you know, what's the more resistant crop or how to combat these diseases and pests, I mean, it just helps them so much.
Oh, yeah, definitely. One of the farmers I spoke with just said that those types of research projects, they just saved the farmers so much time and effort and money as well. Some of those research projects had even brought in equipment, like harvesting or processing equipment to test in different conditions. And so that'll also help farmers see, like, okay, is this several thousand dollar piece of equipment going to be worth it for my situation?
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, the good work that those agents do, because it is such a challenge for the farmers, you know, as they try and survive doing, you know, what they love to do.
Yeah, no, the extension team is just, they're such an important support for our local agricultural industry.
And the state lawmakers provided some support for this program.
Yes. In 2024, the legislature provided 5 extension agent positions. So this was to fill expertise gaps that were created by retirements and then also a subsequent loss of positions. And then this past session, the Ledge also funded a new permanent extension agent in Kona, and then some of the support staff as well across the islands.
Well, we certainly salute those agents that are out there, you know, helping the farmers thrive and not just survive. Thank you for highlighting this for us, Noelle.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Noelle Fujiorire from Overstory Hawaii. Look for her article online. Picture a car drift race. Now shrink it to 1/10 of the scale. There's a small but tight-knit community of remote control car drifting here in Hawaii. With the remote control, drivers control cars around the racetrack where the objective is to swerve, veer, and drift the car without losing control. The Conversation's Laura Dukes recently attended a practice run at Ainakoa Park in East Honolulu. Roy Urata is a co-founder of the RC Drift Team, Psycho. The members are preparing to attend the Super Drift Championship in California this fall.
Okay, so Roy, explain what I'm looking at here.
Okay, so we're going to watch this pair right here. So the lead car, he's going around the course. We don't really have like the full zones set up tonight. Normally you'll have like a box on the ground that will designate where we want the lead car to slide through. If it's on the outside of the lane, we want him to slide through it with the back tires. And if it's on the nose portion of the, or the front part of the lane, we would want the front part of the car to slide through that box. Generally, we want the car to slide through each turn without straightening out. If they straighten out, that would be like an incomplete. Same if they spin out. And in this instance, so like how the blue car is following that white car, he's just trying to mimic the movements of the white car. Oh, see, and it's like he spun out, so that would be incomplete for the lead car. But ideally, yes, everybody's just trying to follow the car in front of them as close as they can without making any contact.
Now, these tiny cars are nothing like Hot Wheels or penny racers. A basic drifting car will set you back $500. Serious drifters will pay up to $6,000 to trick out their vehicles. The local Hawaii drifting community has more than 50 drivers and is even expanding to the neighbor islands. Duke spoke with Urata about how he got into this micro motorsport.
Hawaii Raceway Park shut down in 2006, and we haven't had a track since, for real cars at least. So that's where some of our friends moved away to the mainland to pursue drifting, and others of us have like just gotten further into remote control, and yeah, still travel for remote control, but we can still practice that here at home.
I think for someone who maybe has never seen drifting before, but knows what a car race is, how is it different?
Drifting is different than regular car racing because there's tire smoke everywhere and the cars are not going straight. They are sliding with like 45 degrees of angle where they look like they would be out of control, but they're just trying to glide around as close to the walls and barriers as they can while putting on a show for the crowd. It's not about who gets to the finish line first. It's more so who can perform what the judges are looking for if you're talking about competition. And then if you're watching a drift event that's just more like a demo or something, it's all about being exciting from a driver's standpoint and putting on a show for the crowd.
I think that's really interesting because I know visually what drifting looks like, but I didn't know it's not a race.
Competition drifting is not racing. I mean, you do have a speed element to it because of the different tire compounds and things like that. But yeah, it's still about being able to fill the zones with as much angle as you can, running the proper line that the judges want you to be on, and getting as close to the barriers as you can.
But RC drifting is a little unique in that it's like taking the image of that and replicating it to the best of its capability, yeah. Smaller.
When we started, all the radio control cars were four-wheel drive, standard touring cars that you would race, but you just put hard tires on and to make them slide. And since then, over those years, it's evolved to have like higher gear ratios in the rear to make the back tires spin faster than the front. The current cars you're looking at now are strictly rear-wheel drive, so they have a big steering angle, like 60 degrees, 70 degrees of steering lock, like how the real pro drift cars do. We use electronics and like a steering gyro to help us catch the initial steering. Like we would equate that to being like power steering in a car. But the motors and the speed controls have a lot more adjustment to them now. And even the layouts of the cars, weight balance wise, are a lot more like the pro drift cars than before.
You saw your first race, and that's how you kind of got into drifting. You were hooked from that. But what really drew you in to the uniqueness of RC drifting?
I really liked being able to mimic what I wanted to, well, what I was seeing in videos without the limitations, per se, of having to drive around on the street because we didn't have a track anymore. And also, I'm into a wide variety of vehicles, so the remote control car, I can keep the same chassis and I can just change the body out every month or every like week if I wanted to, as opposed to changing out the complete car and having to start all over, yeah. So that really appealed to me. I like being able to drive with my friends, and in reality, even though we crash into each other, the consequences are nothing like what it would be in a real car. I mean, I'm not saying that it would be like life-threatening or anything in a real car if you're on a track, but like we can crash into each other and keep going like it's no problem. You would still have mechanical issues that you'd have to repair in a real car. So, and it's cheaper.
Yeah, I think on that, this is far cheaper than a drifting car.
Yes.
But it's still like, you're still putting a decent amount of work and care into this.
Yes. The cars have a lot of adjustments from alignment to track width, shock setups as far as like what kind of oil you want to put in there, different spring rates.
Oil and motors, that's crazy. It really does sound like you're talking about a car.
Yeah, we are. We are talking about an electric car, but yeah, it's got all the same elements to it. This electronic speed control would be basically like an ECU in a regular car. So it has a lot of adjustments that you can make. Changing the gear ratio in this changes the power band, so you can change the how much punch you have when you pull the throttle. Braking setups change. Even the servos now are programmable to have different speeds and things like that. Yeah. You can get really into it and tinker a lot with the different settings, or you can keep it simple and still have fun. Yeah, so just depends on how far you want to take it.
How has like something that you saw as a teenager gotten you here?
I guess I always had passion for drifting. It really appealed to me that I could do this and maintain. A lot of it was how far I wanted to take it. So to me, the remote control car was not so intimidating to get in and learn how to work on it and things like that. So that just promoted me to further progress myself in the hobby. And the friendships that I've built over the years with my team and even friends from around the world now, yeah, they are really important to my life.
What is something that being in this for a while that has kind of like stuck with you or like changed your life in any way?
A lot of the draw to the hobby is the community. You know, life is hectic for all of us nowadays, so it's nice to have a group that shares a common interest and we can come together and kind of blow off steam for a few hours on a couple nights a week. Competitions are very different from a regular practice session because they have to have so much structure, and we have just different points that we have to hit as an organizer to legitimately qualify for a series. But you know, for some that is what attracts them, and that's totally cool. And at the other end, you have the people who just want to get together and hang out and just enjoy just driving together. And or it can be even like painting and detailing out the different body shells and things. You know, there's a whole community around that too. So there's something for everybody. Drifting appeals to a very wide demographic, not just in age, but just of different people in general. So it's still good to see that it's not all about the money. You can still take a very cheap entry-level car. Like there's a family over there that's just starting out, and they're having just as much fun as somebody that has like a really expensive car. So it's really awesome. The more that people are exposed to that and understand that, the further our hobby will grow in general.
That was Roy Arata. He's the co-founder of the RC Drift Team Psycho. The final round of the Super Drift Race Championship takes place at Palolo Elementary School on August 30th. If you want to try your hand at it, registration is open to all. You can find more info on the race and see their cars in action on their Instagram at Team Psycho. And we can share that our intern Laura took a spin controlling Roy's car after their interview, and she spun out. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to talk libraries. The state's summer reading challenge ends today. Give us some feedback. Call or talk backline at 808-792-8217 and record something, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.